Republican lawmakers are still pushing for a vote on a health care plan that would repeal and replace, the phrase goes, Obamacare.
An amendment adding $8 billion in spending may tip some lawmakers in favor of the bill, but House leaders are still counting the votes to see if they have enough support.
Paul Singer joins us now to recap that and some other top stories in national politics. He's USA Today's Washington correspondent. Paul, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back, and thanks for having me on Pledge Day. Everybody should be donating.
Well, it sounds like there's a pledge of $8 billion trying to pass this plan through the House, Paul. This has been going since that dramatic day when the bill didn't come to a vote. There's been this percolating back and forth. What's the latest effort to get enough Republican votes to pass this thing?
Well, you're right. It is $8 billion over a period of 4 years, I believe, pay for it's called high-risk pools. The whole theory here is they want to do two things at once. They want to give the conservatives the victory in repealing a bunch of mandatory standards that were created by Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, that is mandatory standards for insurance policies. At the same time, they want to give moderates the right to say that some of those mandatory standards have been protected. And in this case, we're talking about the protection for pre-existing conditions. Obamacare famously said that you can't be denied coverage for your pre-existing condition. So now, the way the bill is written, it would allow states to seek a waiver so that, in fact, you could be denied coverage for pre-existing condition. But in order to make the moderates happy, they say, okay, well, here's $8 billion basically go into a pool that would help you buy coverage if your state gets a waiver. It is a very complex bit of math they are executing. So here's the question. Does that satisfy the conservatives enough while also satisfying the moderates enough to get this bill to pass? And remember, we're talking just about the Republicans. Not a single Democrat's going to vote for this thing. At the moment, we don't know if they have their votes.
And this is Republicans in the House. This isn't even talking about the Senate yet. Whether even if they can pass something, there's the question of whether the Senate would give it the time of day.
Correct. By most accounts, there is not enough support in the Senate to pass any of this stuff. It will be renegotiated again if they – I don't honestly even know if they would take up the framework. But, you know, for a lot of the moderates, they view this problem is their – the way the bill is drafted – it's going to raise premiums in the near term on their elderly, particularly constituents, and it is also going to reduce coverage for their Medicaid recipients, and they think that that's bad news.
Some people have said, hey, what's the rush here? These new changes, including this new $8 billion, hasn't been scored by the Congressional Budget Office. What would be the rush? Why do Republican House leaders feel like they're under time pressure here?
Well, you really don't want to know the answer to this question, but...
Oh, I do.
it gets complicated fast. Because they're trying to do this through something called budget reconciliation, which is the way that you can pass legislation with a 50-vote majority in the Senate instead of needing a 60-vote filibuster-proof majority, you do it on a budget bill. The problem is they want to do tax reform on a budget bill, too, and for that... they need to pass a second budget bill. It would be basically next year's budget. They're doing this one, the health care bill, under this year's budget. And the premise is you can't do them both at the same time. You can't have two budget bills live at once. So you got to get health care out of the way so that you can open the door to do tax reform.
Talking to Paul Singer from USA Today, looking at some of the top stories in the news. So before we move on from healthcare, Paul, I mean, what's going on? They're counting votes one at a time in the House to see if they got this thing?
They are. One of my reporters is over there right now. The House just had a vote, and she sent me an email back saying, well, I asked for interviews for a bunch of the undecided members, and none of them came to talk to us. So I suspect the Republican leadership is doing exactly what my reporters are doing, which is trying to corner these people in the hallway and ask them whether they're a yes or a no.
Well, I want to talk for a minute about an interesting piece you wrote yourself, Paul. You get to write stuff sometimes.
Once in a while.
Yeah.
Every now and then.
We often hear before an election, if candidate blank wins, I'm moving to Canada. And there was a lot of this with, right. If Trump wins, People would say they were going to move to Canada, they didn't want to be part of America run by Donald Trump. You hit the streets, you hit the pavement, and you tried to dig up whether more people had been filing to move to Canada. What did you discover?
Well, we discovered the answer is a little bit yes, but not really a big yes. Every year, the average of Americans getting permanent residence in Canada for the past decade or so has ranged between 8,000 and 10,000 people. The first quarter of this year, there was about 2,300 Americans who relocated, got permanent residence into Canada. That's up somewhat from the first quarter of last year and the first quarter of the year before, like up by a couple of hundred. But the quarters, they sort of variable. Some quarters it's 1,900, some quarters it's 1,500. If this kept up at this rate, you get to 9,000, 9,500 American move to Canada this year. That would be a big year. It would not be a historically big year, but it would be a big year. But we just don't know whether it's really going to keep up with that rate. And even if it does, I don't think it shows a stampede. And there's a lawyer we've talked to a couple times up there who said, people move to Canada for two reasons. They get a job or they get married. That's basically it. Very few people are up here because they're running from the politics of America.
So this is not a great, if I can paraphrase H. Ross Perot, a great sucking sound of Americans heading across the border.
I don't think so. Now, again, call me back in 3 months. We'll see what the second quarter of 2017 is. And if we're up to, 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 people by then maybe we're into something. And I will say that I've seen a couple of interesting comments from folks that one of the things that's happening is that non-Americans are going to Canada, which is to say if you're here as on a visitor's visa, you might relocate to Canada because you just don't think at this point the Trump administration is going to extend your visitor status in America, so you're looking for somewhere else to go. That's possible, harder to track.
Getting back to Congress and money and funding stuff, now there was this question of maybe a shutdown coming up. We heard earlier this week Democrats, Republicans agreed on this deal. Looks like some voting is maybe happening, has happened on that today. But President Trump has said on Twitter, he said maybe in September or so in the fall when this thing expires, we need a good shutdown. The phrase good shutdown was in one of his tweets. I'm not sure what. What do you make of what he was arguing there?
I don't know. It's very hard to make anything of it. No one in government has ever used the word good in the same sentence as the word shutdown. It is clear that Mr. Trump did not get everything he wanted in the funding bill that just passed 15 minutes ago. He wants money for his border wall, particularly he wants more money for defense spending. He wants deeper cuts in discretionary spending, in the various federal agencies. So maybe he is signaling with that rather oddly timed tweet that he is willing to go to the mat over this, and if it comes down to it, he will shut down the government rather than accept a compromise with Democrats. Every Republican saw that tweet and shook their head and said, no way, we don't want it. We've been through this before, and we get blamed. But who knows? I mean, with Mr. Trump, it's always hard to tell whether the president is staking out a negotiating position or he's just in a bad mood and tweeting.
And he also complained about the filibuster rule in the Senate, which people have done over the years, but he said that's part of the reason we're not getting what we want. And he said, in effect, we need to do what we did for what Harry Reid did for many judges, what the Republicans now did for the Supreme Court, and get rid of the filibuster now for budget measures. Have we heard anything from leading Republicans in the Senate on that?
Yes, we have. Mitch McConnell said, over my dead body. The problem for any majority party getting rid of the filibuster is that someday you're going to be the minority party. And the reason the filibuster exists, by and large, is to prevent the Senate from becoming the House. The House is the place where the minority has no rights whatsoever. The majority of the moment can just stampede their way through their agenda. The country does not really want to be whipsawed every couple of years when you change leadership, and a majority of 51 in the Senate could basically rewrite the entire law book. It's not good politics. It's not good policy.
I want to turn to foreign policy for a moment. Syria, obviously still in the news. President Trump talking to President Vladimir Putin in Russia talking about an effort to come to a ceasefire. Are we seeing maybe room for genuine cooperation there, something that could actually work on the ground?
You know, I don't know much about foreign policy in general, and I got to tell you that Mr. Trump's foreign policy has been a little all over the place, particularly in regards to Syria. It's not clear to me what the agenda is. It was hopeful, I think, to see him reaching out to Mr. Putin, and a conversation can be held. That's good, because 3 weeks ago, I guess it is now, we bombed Syria, suggested that the Russians had been complicit in the Syrians' use of chemical weapons on their own people, and had gotten to this point where basically the most powerful players in the region, us and the Russians, were not on speaking terms about how to solve this problem. So at least there is speaking going on. But it's really hard to know what the resolution is. I mean, the Russians have said all along that they don't see a reason to get rid of Assad, and they see him as basically one of their pawns or protectorates, and we don't. So I don't know exactly how this resolves in a way that works out for both. But I think the best part of that conversation was everybody agreeing that, you know, we need to figure out ways to resolve the conflict and help the humanitarian crisis. Whether we get anywhere from there to a solution, I do not know.
We'll leave it there for now, Paul. Thanks a lot, as always, for joining us.
Thanks, Rob. Have a great day.
You too. That's Paul Singer, Washington correspondent for USA Today. He joined us for our weekly look at the latest in national politics.